Scenes from protests across the state today. Nearly 50,000 academic workers from the University of California's 10 campuses have gone on strike. Among them, teaching assistants, researchers, and postdocs. They're pushing for more than double their salary, plus housing, childcare, and transportation subsidies, as many find themselves priced out of the cities they work in. Joining us now is Blake Jones. He covers education in California for Politico. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so tell us who exactly is striking. What kind of work do they do on campus?
Yeah, so of the 48,000 workers who are out striking today, they cover four different bargaining units that include jobs from, you know, graduate teaching assistants who, you know, do everything from teaching classes to grading papers to academic tutors who work as undergraduates. So they really do cover a, you know, large swath of the work that is, you know, done in assisting tenured professors.
And UC says they're part-time workers. Is that accurate?
Yes, yes. These are part-time workers who are, you know, making sometimes around $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And, you know, some of these workers are looking you know, through negotiations for a doubling of their salaries in some cases, one that the UC has not been willing to offer.
Right. And so on the face of it, is that an outrageous demand to ask for twice your salary in a union negotiation, or is it reasonable given the amount of work that they do in the cities in which they live?
I mean, certainly asking for a doubling of one's salary comes without precedent in higher academic negotiations such as these. But you also hear from union leaders who are saying that they're paying more than 50% of their salary for rent in some cases, in, you know, some of these especially pricey cities that UC's campuses are hosted by. So, you know, it certainly depends on your perspective, but many of these, you know, organizers and folks who are striking today say that they're living at poverty level wages and that the 7%, you know, wage increase that the UC is offering is far from sufficient in giving them livable wages.
Right. So I understand they're looking for a minimum for all grad students at $54,000 a year.
That's correct.
That's right. And then more if you're a postdoc, 70,000.
Right.
And as the UC said, that's just a non-starter.
Yeah, the UC has said that this is a non-starter. The UC has made concessions in bargaining, we've been told, on, you know, issues like anti-harassment and anti-bullying policies. But a lot of these are not the kind of like monetary concessions that that bargaining committees for the academic workers that they're looking for. And, you know, what we've heard from organizers and bargaining committees is that, you know, unless they see a substantial concession on some of these like monetary wage issues, that they're not even going to bring a contract back to their members for a ratification vote.
And they're also asking for other things, right? Subsidies for childcare, for housing, for transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that we can trace this to sort of a growing movement within California labor, where organizers are, you know, looking at issues that that are not just on, you know, on the job kind of working conditions, and also include, you know, financial and non-financial provisions that can help them try to survive off the job. So, yeah, your point that you make is, you know, one that's echoed by organizers who say that, you know, if you can't afford something like childcare, that is going to, you know, inhibit your ability to do your job. It's going to stop you from being able to, you know, afford your apartment when you're just working on a part-time salary. And yeah, they say that these issues that revolve around, you know, their living conditions have a really harsh impact on their working conditions.
So they have been negotiating for more than a year. Is that right?
Right. And they have not been able to reach a consensus over this time. You know, we can really trace a lot of this tension back, I think, to 2021, you know, at which point one of the bargaining unit's contracts expired. And, you know, since then, you know, they've not been able to ratify a new contract with the UC. And over that time, you know, we've heard updates on bargaining, but it seems like the needle really has not, you know, moved toward compromise. And On November 2nd, the workers held a vote to set this strike in motion that began today. And over 75% of members of the bargaining units participated. 97% of participants voted in favor of the strike, setting it in motion. And since then, we have not seen a compromise reached. The union has reported that there were significant progress made over the weekend, but nothing that is bringing the two sides anywhere close to a final contract agreement.
So what does that mean for students? Because, as you said, a lot of the work gets done by graduate students, by the people on strike today, teaching classes, grading papers, et cetera. So what does that mean for instruction?
So that means that some students who are not going to have their grade, their papers graded for the foreseeable future. It also means that students who are taught by graduate level students who are teaching undergraduate sections won't have any class today. And generally the disruptions that are happening to campus operations are variable based on how many people are participating in the strike at a given campus, but this is a really key time for some of these disruptions to be happening. I think many have pointed out that finals are just around the corner, and this is, a part of the year that many students are relying on, teachers' assistants to, help them prep for finals, have some of these, 9 p.m. kind of study sessions that we think of teaching assistants holding as they, prepare for students for finals. And, since this strike is open-ended and we don't have an idea of when it could conclude, since we, haven't seen big concessions from either party, it's, unclear whether students are going to get any reprieve.
Well, will full professors cross the picket line and teach these sections?
Your guess is probably as good as mine on that question. I haven't, I haven't heard from any professors who are willing to do that so far. I have, however, heard from professors who say that they support the strike, and, while disruptions to learning are unfortunate, they're, in support of the students and, coming from a pro-labor perspective.
Blake Jones, California education reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, if Republicans flip the House, they can partially thank the Supreme Court. Our legal Jessica Levinson will explain next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Nearly a week after the end of the midterms, we are still waiting to find out who will control the House. If Republicans capture the majority, it'll likely be by a much smaller margin than pundits and pollsters had anticipated. One reason, Speaker Nancy Pelosi could hand her gavel to her fellow Californian Kevin McCarthy. Well, the Supreme Court. Earlier this year, the justices let stand legislative maps that were racially discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. We're going to talk about how that decision may have affected the midterms with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and an expert on elections, redistricting, and the Supreme Court. Most importantly, however, on her extensive CV is that she is our legal here on Press Play. Hello.
Most importantly, indeed. Hello.
So remind us where these maps were drawn, which states, and how they wound up before the Supreme Court.
Yes. So we're really talking about maps that were drawn in Alabama, Louisiana, and Georgia. And in all of those cases, lower court judges, district court judges said, I'm looking at these districts, and I think they violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is another way of saying, I think they're illegal racial gerrymanders that you, for instance, packed all of the Black voters into one district so that they couldn't voice their views. They couldn't pick the candidate of their choosing in other districts. And what happened is, or what should happen, is that you redraw the district lines. If you found that there is an illegal racial gerrymander, then we know the solution. You say, go back and add districts. And that's what the lower court judges said in each of these cases. Go back and add a majority-minority district. What happened, of course, is that the Alabama case was actually appealed directly to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 order, said, yeah, we're going to go ahead and let those district lines stand for the election. The election was 3 months away, but they said, we're going to let the district lines stand because we're simply too close to the election. Basically, after that, a Georgia district court judge said, yeah, I think there's also racial gerrymander here, but I'm looking at what the Supreme Court just said about the Alabama case. And so we'll use these lines for the midterm elections. And something very similar happened in Louisiana as well, where the Supreme Court basically just put those lines on hold, saying, we're going to hear a case about redistricting in the fall.
Okay, so now that the midterms have come and gone, or sort of gone, what does that mean for these cases?
So right now that the midterms are here and they're gone, and what does it mean? Well, the court heard arguments the second day of the term on October 4th dealing with the Alabama case. So that case argued, the merits of that case were argued. And given this particular court, I think it's just inescapable that they will probably whittle away at Section 2 Voting Rights Act protections. And that means we don't know if in the end these districts will have to be redrawn.
All right. So looking at the results of the midterms, can you draw a direct line between these cases and what happened?
I think you can. If there is really a Republican majority by only 3 votes, for instance, all we have to do, in my mind, is look at these 3 states where judges said you need to redraw, you need to add majority-minority districts. And we know in those states that the minorities do break heavily for Democrats. And see, really, that would have been an additional 3 votes. Now, of course, these midterms are also happening against the backdrop of a Supreme Court that said only less than 5 years ago, we're not going to weigh in on partisan gerrymandering. So we saw a lot of district lines where there's one party or another that really aggressively drew lines to try and pick up seats. And frankly, Republicans are typically better at that. And the last thing is, we saw that this is a midterm election that's held after the Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Shelby County, where they trashed basically half of the Voting Rights Act. So I think all of those things add up to, frankly, a Republican majority in the House.
Right. But you also have New York State, right? And they redistrict, and that was, they initially gave an advantage to Democrats, which was thrown out by a court there. So what about that state as the potential swing state in control of the House?
So I think that's a good point. A lot of people are pointing to, well, what about what happened in New York? I think that's different because in that case, what the judge found is there's a problem, and they in fact remedied that problem. They redrew the lines. Now, we can quibble with how they redrew the lines, but the point is that they found there was a problem and they said, okay, well, let's rectify this. In Alabama and Louisiana and Georgia, we know there's a problem. We know it's race-based, and mm-hmm. we lived with it.
Okay, so moving on to the other side of the Capitol in the Senate, the Democrats do have control after Catherine Cortez Masto won re-election in Nevada, a squeaker there. So that means President Biden will have the opportunity to reshape the federal judiciary for 2 more years because the Senate confirms his judicial nominees. So what does that mean? Is he going to proceed quickly in filling these vacancies, and how many are there?
I hope he proceeds more than quickly, because President Biden was, of course, when he was senator, on the Judiciary Committee, and he knows how important it is to fill these vacancies. There are 85 Article III vacancies as of today, meaning district court judges and court of appeals judges. And I think he absolutely understands that there is not a moment to waste. You know, we have a lot of discussions about, will the president be able to push through his legislative agenda? Will he be able to implement a program by executive order? And I think what we see time and time again is that's only the first question. The first question is, can you pass this legislatively or can you enact this by executive order? The next question is, will the courts uphold it? And so that's why it you can't overemphasize how important it is for the Biden administration to fill those vacancies before even a year goes by.
Okay. And one case to illustrate that is the student loan forgiveness plan. And it's pretty confusing because there seems to be a new court decision almost every week. Didn't we just talk about this?
We did just talk about it, but that was actually a different case. There have been a lot of cases that have challenged the student loan program. That was a case dealing with six Republican-led states that sued. And that case was actually dismissed for lack of standing. Just this morning, the Eighth Circuit said, we're going to go ahead and push pause, a nationwide injunction on the Biden administration program while we consider this. But there's a separate case out of Texas that the court ruled on last Friday, I believe. And that was brought not by Republican-led states, but that was brought by two plaintiffs who basically were either totally ineligible or partially ineligible for the program. And in that case, a district court judge who was appointed by President Trump said, I'm also implementing a preliminary injunction. And so for that reason as well, the program is on hold.
Okay. So it all comes down to the fact that you cannot now apply. If you wanted to apply, you can't do that right now.
Exactly. There's a bunch of legal arguments here that I think are really meaty, but for people to understand, at this point, we've pushed pause on your ability to apply at all. I think about 26 million people have already applied. It will be sorted out in the courts. I think the final decision here should be that nobody actually has standing to sue to challenge this, but we've got to wait a little bit. And there's another option for the Biden administration for those people who have applied, where they could try and do this on a more case-by-case basis as opposed to this much larger program.
All right. Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and, of course, our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fresh look at a death that shook the art world back in the 80s. A new podcast examines the death of artist Anna Mendieta. Her husband, sculptor Carl Andre, was found not guilty, but questions remain.
You know, history is long, and the judgments of a contemporary moment are just that, judgments for the moment.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. On a cool September night in 1985, the artist Anna Mendieta fell out of her apartment window in New York City and died. She was 36 years old when she fell from the 34th floor. She was a rising star in the city's art scene at the time, known for painting with blood in some of her images. Her work explored violence, especially against women. A few months before she died, she married sculptor Carl Andre, considered one of the fathers of minimalism. Theirs was, by all accounts, a turbulent relationship. Mendieta's friends and family believe that Carl Andre killed her, pushed her, or threw her out of the window during an argument. Andre was prosecuted for murder and acquitted. And in the decades since, his career has flourished. His art is in major museum collections. But how much should the circumstances surrounding the death of his wife be factored in when considering his art and his place in the art world? That idea is explored in a new podcast called Death of an Artist. It's hosted by curator Helen Molesworth, who's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. Well, let's first get to know a bit about both of the artists in your podcast. Tell us about Anna Mendieta. Who was she and what kind of work did she do?
Yeah, of course. Anna Mendieta was an extraordinary artist. She was born and raised in Cuba, and she's actually ends up living in Iowa, of all places, with her sister. And she lands there and ends up going to the University of Iowa, which, again, it's completely improbable, has one of the most radical art programs of the 70s. And everyone who is in New York, it's like a who's who roster, comes through, and she is exposed to some of the most avant-garde art of the 1970s and leaps in, you know, feet first, and just begins making these extraordinary performance pieces. As you mentioned in your intro, some of them used blood, but often they were really involved in her making imprints in the land with her body, covering her body in feathers or blood or mud or leaves, really probing work that dealt with both the violence that the patriarchy mets out on female bodies, but also this pulling around memory and the land and the landscape and how important the earth is and how much we neglect her. So that was really Mendieta.
Wow. So I guess when you look at her work, and you know, it's interesting, as I was listening to your podcast, I happened to check out the Joan Didion exhibition at the Hammer, and there are several works by her. And I do look at them differently, having learned a lot from your podcast about her and the circumstances surrounding her death. But it is an image of a body in the sand. And then in subsequent images, that image is erased by the water.
Right.
So it is interesting to look at her work now through this other lens of knowing what happened to her. And I guess that is one of the central questions, as I indicated in the intro in your podcast, is how do we look at an artist's work when we do or do not consider their lives and the factors surrounding their work and how they live their lives?
That's right. You know, for really quite some time now, there's been a kind of tacit or unofficial separation of the artist and their life from the work that they make. Museums tend to present the work as if it arrived, you know, from Mars, not perhaps from, you know, Iowa or New Jersey, made by a person. And this, of course, contributes to the idea that art is timeless and that art is mythic and that art is universal. But it's kind of hard to maintain that division, because of course people are really curious about artists and they want to know who made the thing. And artists themselves are making work using their own experiences as the reservoir of material that they're going to draw from to make art. So this separation of the art and the artist is problematic in an era where, you know, we have come to understand that our personal identities really shape how we see the world and how we move through the world and how we are seen in the world.
And especially how the art world sees men, male artists, and women, female artists. And at that time, when the women's movement was in full force in the 70s and feminist art was coming to the fore, it was challenging a lot of these, you know, ways of being, ways of seeing, if you will, that dominated the art world. Can we talk a little bit now about Carl Andre? Because he represents the other pole. He was a very much revered, or is, because he's still alive, very much revered artist, the father of minimalism. Can you describe his work?
Sure. Andre has a really major breakthrough in the history of sculpture. Sculpture always has this problem of you make an object and then you need to do something with it in order to display it. And Andre decides, basically, screw the pedestal. I'm going to put the work directly on the floor. And in doing so, he made work that mimicked the floor. So they're very thin, square metal plates that are typically arranged in a grid. And in a big gesture, he decided that the viewer could walk on them, so that you could treat the artwork as if it were the floor, or you could see this intervention as breaking the kind of fundamental rule of museums, which is do not touch. Like, all of a sudden, the viewer is given agency to make a set of choices. Am I going to walk around the sculpture, or am I going to walk on top of the sculpture? And Carl was in the 60s and 70s, a huge art star. He was a politically very much a leftist, very progressive. You know, he helped to fund feminist art movements. He was an anti-war activist. I mean, he had what we would consider to be kind of exemplary politics. But he was also known to be a heavy drinker, which was very much the sort of social mores of the time. There was a lot of alcohol in the art world. And he was known to be, shall we say, a bit of a belligerent or a nasty drunk. He was not a happy drunk. And this was a reputation that attended him as much as the reputation of him being this sort of genius that had made these major breakthroughs in the history of sculpture.
So they meet and they have this turbulent relationship. They get married and it's not a happy marriage, I guess, because she, according to the people that you interview, really was looking to divorce him right before she died. And the night in question, it's not clear exactly what happened, right? To this day, it's unclear what happened. He said she fell out the window. There are various different versions of that he tells. But he's ultimately charged with her murder. And then what happens? What happens at trial?
Well, there were only two people in Carl Andre's apartment the night Anna Mendieta died. So there are no witnesses other than Carl. And one of the things that means is that he gets to say what happened. And the problem is that over the course of the last 30 some odd years, he's said four different things about what happened. They're very different from one another and none of them add up. When they went to trial, the big problem there was that a lot of the evidence had been kind of botched by the New York City PD. They didn't write the search warrant correctly. So all kinds of information, data, facts from the crime scene and from Mendieta's friends and supporters were not deemed admissible at trial. And so Andre is acquitted. The other curious thing about the trial, and it's extremely unusual, particularly in a murder trial, is that Andre opted not to have a jury. So he opted for what's called a bench trial, which means the judge and only the judge would decide the verdict. And so the judge acquitted him because the judge did not feel that the evidence had risen to beyond a reasonable doubt, even though there are many, many, many people in the art world, and I think now beyond the art world, who have lots of reasonable doubt about the judge's ultimate verdict.
But this really did split the art world. And I guess the official art world, the institutional art world, grudgingly held its nose, accepted the verdict, and moved on. Was that the general
reaction? I don't know how grudging it actually was, Madeline. I think that feminists were infuriated and were very, very vocal. And I think most museum staff kind of quietly just went along with business as usual, because to not show the work was to question this big fundamental, often implicit or unspoken rule in the art world, which is that the artist and the artwork are kept separate, you know, that it didn't matter what Carl Andre did in his personal life, that the artwork was the artwork and it got to be shown without any recourse to talking about what might have happened that night, even though many people who showed the work were convinced that he had done something wrong, that he was in fact very implicated in Anna Mendieta's death. But they didn't think you were allowed to talk about that in the space of the museum.
Well, let's play a clip of tape where you ask the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Max Hollein, about that. If the work should have a little explanation on the wall about, I don't know, who this person is. And this is what he said.
If the life of that human being is not exactly ingrained into the artistic work itself, then I think that there's still an issue with that. So if an artist in his life killed two people through drunken driving, so is that then a relevant information that you need to provide the visitor of a museum to see a particular work that obviously has nothing to do with it?
Okay, so what do you think of his reaction there? And, you know, you're a curator. You've had to wrestle with this idea yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think Max is, I mean, with all due respect to Max Hollein, I think he's on the wrong side of history here. I think that it would be unthinkable to imagine that you could screen, you know, the Cosby Show in a classroom and not say what Bill Cosby had been systematically accused of.
But is it a question of degree, like the severity of the accusations, or in Cosby's case, the conviction?
Yeah, and then the overturning of the conviction.
Right.
These waters are treacherous. I'm sure that, yes, of course, it has something to do about the severity. I mean, a lot of people said to me when we were working on the podcast, well, Helen, where will it end? You know, like, what will happen? Will we just have to throw out all these male artists? And I was like, well, it could stop at murder. Murder could be the line. Like, you know, that's a really concrete line we could talk about.
Yeah. But he was acquitted. So.
But he was acquitted, you know, in a trial in which not all of the evidence was viewed by the judge. And yeah, that doesn't seem fair at all. But I think that the question is really sometimes a red herring. I think, you know, Max immediately going to, like, you know, drunk driving, or, you know, what we're talking about here is a history of domestic violence, a history of women being harmed by more powerful men. And what we also know now that was not common knowledge in the 80s when this happened is that 90% of women who are murdered by an intimate. They're murdered by a man that they know. And so the evidence here is just sort of overwhelmingly points to a system that allows men to continue to hurt people who have less power than them. And he was absolutely more powerful than Ana Mendieta in every way, except perhaps historically, because I think one of the other interesting things about this story is that, you know, by the time Ana Mendieta died, everyone had decided that Carl Andre was quote unquote canonical, that he was one for the history books. But now in 2022, it's Mendieta who is the much more powerful figure. She actually has all the traction now. And very few people are involved in a public discussion around Carl Andre's work. So there's also a cautionary tale, I think, about, you know, history is long and the judgments of a contemporary moment are just that, judgments for the moment. Art is long, and it looks right now, if you had to pick a winner, it'd be Ana Mendieta, not Carl Andre. So that's also this really interesting wrinkle in the story.
Hmm. Well, it's a great story, and I urge everyone to go listen to it. Death of an Artist, it's a podcast available wherever you listen to podcasts, hosted by my guest, the curator, Helen Molesworth. Helen, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Madeline. I always appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll meet the musician Alison Russell, whose new album explores her traumatic childhood and how music really helped her. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Blood on my shirt, two ribbons, might have killed me that time. Oh, if I left, he's slow and he's drunk and he. grip on me.
That's Persephone by the Canadian musician Alison Russell. After nearly 20 years of touring and playing with the bands Poe Girl and Birds of Chicago, Russell became a breakout star in Americana music last year with her first solo album, Outside Child. The Americana Music Association named it Album of the Year. It's a story of survival and resilience and how she finally found joy after being severely abused when she was a child. And a warning for you, this conversation and her album covers that period of her life, so please choose now where and when to listen. Alison Russell is performing tomorrow night at the Troubadour in West Hollywood, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Honored to have you. All right. So talk about this decision to make an album on your own after working in collaboration for a couple of decades.
You know, it wasn't so much a decision in some ways. I had applied for a grant to the Canada Council for the Arts. I'm a Canadian living in America, and it was actually a writing grant that I applied for. But I had been on the road most of 2019 with my band, Birds of Chicago, and also with sort of a super group called Our Native Daughters, which is Rhiannon Giddens, Layla McCalla, Amethyst Kia, and me. Kashiba, Kashiba, you're free now, you're free. And we had written all of these songs, and I just kind of couldn't close the floodgates back up, and more songs were coming through. And I have quite a distinct memory of being on the Our Native Daughters tour bus in July of 2019, driving through the night to the Newport Folk Festival and writing what would become the first song of Outside Child on that overnight drive. And I found out right at that time that my writing grant had come through, and it was just exactly enough to book 4 days at my favorite studio in Nashville, which is called the Sound Emporium. And so we did it, and all of my kind of chosen community of musicians were there. And in fact, when we began those recordings, I was in so much denial about making a solo record that I was sort of calling them demos and saying, oh, maybe I'll use some of these for Our Native Daughters, or maybe I'll use some of them for Birds. And, you know, I was in quite a bit of denial about the fact that I was making a solo personal record and statement. But all of my musical community around me realized what was happening and kind of gently guided me into it. So it's really solo in name and sort of subject matter thematically only because it is so much about my community uplifting me in the work that I do and in my life.
Well, so what was that first song that came to you on that bus to Newport?
It was Fourth Day Prayer. And it was quite funny because the buses that we were on two buses. We had all six of our children with us. Between Rhiannon and Layla and I, there are six kids, all the guys in the band and a camera crew from the Smithsonian who were filming a documentary about Our Native Daughters on the other bus. And the most comical part was that the driver of the kids' bus was a misanthrope, I would say, but particularly disliked women and children. And so it was not a great fit for us with Anthony, the bus driver. And my daughter had an accident on that particular overnight drive, and he wouldn't stop. He wouldn't stop the bus. And so it was this comical moment of scrambling. I think I found a Black Myself merch shirt and kind of cleaned up the bunk as best I could and found a bikini stuffed into my purse from a river stop earlier that day. And that's how we rolled into Newport. It was pretty funny. And I found myself just laughing because I thought, well, if this is the worst thing in my life right now is this grouchy bus driver, I've really come a long way. And one of the lines from the song popped into my head, which was, these are the best years of your life. If I'd believed that, I'd have died. Something told me that they lied, so I survived. Oh, I survived. Left home, I was just a child. Slept in the graveyard under the mud. When the sun came up and found my skin, as you made reference to earlier, I am a survivor of childhood sexual, psychological, physical abuse, very severe abuse for over a decade. My abuser was my adoptive father, who was a white supremacist American expat. And, you know, it was not a good scene. And for those of you just listening, I am a Black mixed heritage queer woman. And so it was not a good time in my life. And I think one of the cruelest things we could ever say, honestly, to any teen, whatever they're living through, is these are the best years of your life. Because even if it's just puberty you're going through, it's miserable. We all know it's miserable. Mm-hmm. These are not the best years of your life.
Absolutely.
It gets better. It really does. If it can get that much better for me, it can for you too.
Hmm. Well, so what was it then that, was it the bus driver? Was it that that triggered this outpouring? Was it that it was finally time for you to tell this story? What was it that you thought, okay, now is the time to really talk about what happened to me as a child?
Yeah, no, certainly it wasn't the bus driver. I mean, clearly it was, I mean, it's everything. It's your whole life preceding your first record, really, that triggers it, you know? Mm-hmm. It took me that long to process my childhood, my trauma. It took motherhood. It took finding a group of sisters. It took finding a musical community that uplifted me and accepted me as I was. And it took years of decolonizing my own mind, and I'll never be done with that process, frankly. But it got to the point, motherhood was the catalyst, I think, for me, of realizing that at some point I would need to use my words more bravely, because I'm always telling my child that, use your words. But what am I doing to use my words to reduce harm in the world? You know, I had to ask myself that question, and I had to ask myself, what kind of ancestor do I want to be? Well, I want to be a good future ancestor. And in order to do that, I believe that I need to try and do everything I can with what I have, what gifts I have, meager though they may be, to reduce harm in the world right now. That's what I'm given to do. I don't want my daughter to have to carry the same burdens. The album is not about abuse. It's about the journey out of abuse. You know, the transformative power of art and love and community is really what the record is about.
You used this interesting phrase just now, decolonizing my mind. I just want you to talk a little bit about choosing to use that word decolonizing. What did you mean by that?
I mean it quite literally. I think that the forces, the toxic hierarchical forces of colonization that tell people of color we're lesser than, that tell anyone who's on the queer spectrum we're lesser than, who tell new immigrants they're lesser than, or women that they're lesser than and shouldn't be in charge of their own bodies, you know, those same forces are why my American expat father believed he could do what he did to me. You know, he was raised in a sundown town in Indiana. There are still sundown towns in our country. We're not past it. Yeah. You know, he was an abused child. He was abused not only physically by his family, but also ideologically. I believe that indoctrinating our children in hateful and violent ideologies is a form of child abuse. What happened to the Hitler Youth was child abuse. What happens to children growing up being brainwashed with white supremacist ideology, that's child abuse. And he was a child who grew up with those beliefs. And when he moved to Canada, he brought those beliefs with him. And those beliefs, by the way, are alive and well in Canada too. But he did not see me as human, because in fact, the constitution of this country told him and everybody else for many, many, many years that I was 3/5 of a human being, anyone who looked like me. And that doesn't just go away. It doesn't just disappear. And that's what I mean by decolonizing. I was raised in a white supremacist household to believe that I was worth less, literally worth less than other humans in the world. And I believed that story for years and years. You know, a lot of us carry internalized self-hatred that generally takes the form of self-harm. It certainly did in my case.
And your mom is, your mom is white. Correct?
She is. Mm-hmm.
So your biological father is from Grenada, and he was a student in Canada when he met your mom, but he left the country, I understand, before they both realized that she had become pregnant with you. And so you never knew your dad?
No, I didn't meet my Black family until I was 30 years old.
Oh, wow.
So I was raised in a racist town because Montreal struggles with very severe racism. It's a beautiful place too, but it's also intensely segregated. It's more segregated than anywhere I've been in the South.
Oh, really?
In Montreal, we would get stared down and I would be questioned constantly. And essentially the question, because I was in a white biased, if not completely white supremacist environment at all times, the question was always essentially, why are you Black? Why are you here? You know, where are you from? And if I said I'm from Montreal, born and raised, they'd say, no, where are you really from? Mm-hmm. Which is not a question that was ever asked of my white brother, you know?
Yeah. And one of the lines in your song, Fourth Day Prayer, says, Father used me like a wife, mother turned the blindest eye. Stole my body, spirit, pride, he did each night. Where was your mother when all this was happening?
She was often altered on substances, and he encouraged that. She worked nights a lot. She literally turned a blind eye because that man was, unfortunately, in my bed almost every night, and she did nothing. But she's also, in this instance, a victim, because my mom is almost 30 years his junior. She was barely out of teenhood when she met him. She was in severe aftershocks, I believe, of both postpartum depression and in the early onset of very, very severe schizophrenia, which went undiagnosed for years. You know, in some ways, I view my mom more as an older sister in the situation that we were in, who never left, whose mind was so thoroughly colonized and brainwashed that she never left, and she has not left him to this day. And it breaks my heart. Absolutely breaks my heart. But, you know, it's also, there are the things that we can control and the things that we can't. And I can be there to support her if and when she ever chooses to leave, but I can't force her to leave, you know? And that breaks my heart, but that's the truth.
Yeah. Just listening to you, and we just met at the beginning of this interview, so I don't know you. You just sound so together, and I don't know how to really ask you this, but I'm just wondering, given the extent of your abuse, so serious as you've just described it, how is it that you're not a mess? I mean, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to handle that and maybe would turn to substances or other things and just be broken, but you don't sound broken at all.
I think the miracle of my survival is by the grace of my ancestors and the resilience of my ancestors, and we all carry that ancestral resilient strength. That's the other side of the coin of all the abuse and bigotry that, you know, every branch of the human family, the one human family, has been plagued by. The other side of that coin is resilience and strength. That's our birthright, I believe. And in my case, art, music, I was very lucky to be in Montreal. And I am someone who happens to process the world through music. And I found that early. And my mom, in fact, was the first one to open that door and to show me that gift. My mom is a beautiful piano player and singer. And I felt connected to her through music, even when she couldn't show me love in any other way. You know, I can remember very early memories of like hiding under the piano as she played, because I knew if she saw me, there would be confrontation. It would be yelling and scary. But if I just hid and was very small and quiet, I could just bask in the music. Honestly, to me, I remember that feeling of the sound was also felt warm to me. It felt like love. It felt like her love made manifest in the only way that she could.
Oh, my Montreal, can I dream of you tonight?
And I've never stopped feeling that way about music. Music is transformative. And it really is through art and the community of people that I met through art. That is why I'm, you know, relatively okay. And I appreciate you for saying that. I think we're all messes in our various ways, you know.
But through no fault of our own, some people have had to suffer a lot more than others. And you, unfortunately, are one of them.
But Yola and I always talk about this. There's no trauma Olympics. Trauma is trauma. And none of us is getting out of this life without experiencing it or, by the way, alive. So, you know,
right.
So savor and hang on to these goodnesses and each other while we have each other, you know.
That's beautiful. Well, let me play a song that illustrates what you've just been talking about. And this is actually your newest song. It's a duet with the musician Brandi Carlile. It's called You're Not Alone.
In the cradle of the circle, in the cradle of the circle, all the ones who came before you, all the ones who came before you, the strength is yours.
Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today. You really are an inspiration, and your music is just beautiful. Congratulations on the album, and congratulations on the tour. Alison Russell, who will be playing tomorrow at the Troubadour in West Hollywood. Go see her. Alison, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We are at KCRW Press Play. And you can also download and subscribe to our podcast, of course, at KCRW or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today. I'll see you tomorrow. You're not alone.